And welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz back in the chair. Great job last week, Adam. And yeah. Just a shout out to a couple new listeners in the basement of Blackwood Hall. Thank you for listening, and we'll do our best to give you a good show, a really big show.
Why are they in the basement?
It's a long story. I don't have time. Hi,
All
guys.
Right. We should also thank Candace for stopping last week.
Yes, absolutely. Stellar stuff.
Absolutely. Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Just go to cfru.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of the screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel. Today we will talk about 26 pages, and that is the 26 pages of information redacted from the 9/11 report, and they allegedly implicate the Saudi government in aiding and abetting the terrorists that perpetrated the September 11th attacks. But should those pages be made public, and are there risks to their exposure? And then we will say goodbye to Stephen Harper as he allegedly says goodbye to politics tonight at the Conservative Convention in Vancouver. What's he going to do? What's his legacy going to be? And where has he been? We'll talk about all that. And then finally, we will try and have a friendly and open discussion about taxation, following in the example of the Star's Edward Keenan. If we don't want to increase taxes on the municipal level anymore, what do we do? What do we cut? How do we raise capital? We're going to have a frank and... perhaps terrifying open discussion about that. But first, we're going
to... be very afraid.
Well, we don't know where it's going to go. It's going to be a very loose segment. First, though, we're going to talk about this thing called the Brexit. In less than a month, residents of the UK are going to go to the polls and decide whether or not they should leave or remain. No, that's the name of the two sides I discovered as we were researching this topic.
It's so formally, the leave side and the remain side.
The leave and the remain side, yes.
Indeed.
So as our veteran... UK correspondent Scotty Hertz, I will let you begin.
Yikes, hot seat right away. I love it. Yeah, this it is a total war between the two sides, I think. This past week was a study came out from something called the Institute of Fiscal Studies, said that if the UK decides to leave, there will be more austerity, the economy is going to shrink, and I think the sort of scare side is winning in terms of convincing public opinion, because it seems that the latest poll that I saw was saying that the people who traditionally go with the leave side, which is people who generally vote conservative, older people... Old white, well, yeah. And what was the third group? There were three groups. They said, it escapes me anyway. You know those three groups? Yeah, so they, I'm supposed to know the three groups. It'll come to me like halfway through. Men. Males is a category, of course.
Yeah.
I should know that. Are being swayed towards the, well, you know, we should probably stay side. It seems it's, not quite neck and neck, but 55 remaining and 42 saying leave in the definitely going to vote people. And I think that's – I think there are 48 million eligible to vote across the UK. And of those, probably the probability is 65 to 70% of them will vote. But the number is higher if you count everybody. It's like 20 – it's 20% ahead for the Remain side. So I think they're seeing the writing on the wall in terms of the potential economic fallout, which is probably the biggest fallout of this whole thing. For example, one of the things that would have to happen is that they would have to pretty much come up with a trade agreement with every single country again.
Yeah.
So
161 countries.
And that's what's happened with the European Union is that the beef is it went from being an economic body until the period of the Maastricht Treaty, which was 93. Is that right? 93.
Sounds right.
And then it's sort of headed more in the political direction. And that is what most of the beef is about, I think, rather than the economic side. Although there will be economic fallout if they do decide to leave.
Yeah, because old white conservative guys who kind of reap the benefits of this $9 billion price tag that they're – or £9 billion price tag, I should say, in terms of the loss of trade. It's the politics of the thing, and it seems to be that the Leave side is including the UKIP's leader, are kind of galvanizing around these immigration numbers that show that 300,000 333,000 people immigrated to the United Kingdom last year, which is it's not a statistically significant number. The British office that looks at these numbers, that according to them, this isn't a statistically significant number in terms of immigration. But there was a promise as made on the part of David Cameron and the Conservative government that they would try and keep immigration under 100,000. That plus concerns about migrants, you know, Syrian refugees, you know, the general, shall we say, nationalistic tendencies that are currently prevalent in Europe seem to be what's angering up the Leave side. And I'm not sure that's the message perhaps more reasonable people like Boris Johnson, I'm thinking of, for former mayor of London, who do have concerns about remaining in the European Union. So it's almost become a straw man in some of those grander issues going on in Europe right now.
Yeah, and that's the problem, is that the xenophobic types are all over this. Yeah. So there is a bit of a, you know, there is the economic side to it, but then there's the whole, you know, keep Britain pure. And it's not just restricted to the UK as well, because, I mean, there's lots of other countries where that tendency is becoming quite clear, sort of, and yeah, strengthened is probably the wrong word. It's becoming more prevalent with the refugee crisis, in terms of, you know, we don't want those. And I'm quoting here, you know, the Islamic influence in our country, which is ridiculous stuff, right? But that's that's sort of it's almost a sidebar to what's going on. But people are indeed listening to the UKIP types and the Pegida and all these parties across Europe. They're like, well, we want out because this situation is being imposed on us by Europe, and we want to keep our country. There's this whole, you know, that hearkening back to the old Britannia, this kind of in the back of people's minds, where
the empire days,
exactly. So, which included India and Hong Kong and places like that. So it's not as if it was, you know, white is right. Well, it was white is right, but that's a topic for another time.
But white was on top.
Well, exactly, and that's the attitude. This you know, the nationalistic imperialist, the usual. And when you've got stuff like the essentially, I wouldn't call him Nazi, but severely right-leaning presidential race in Austria,
yeah,
where he came very close to winning the top job. I mean, that's huge. So the trend isn't just limited to the UK. But, of course, UKIP famously, you know, the seats in the European Parliament, but it's like they're there strictly to fight it. So.
Yeah, they're the – not that I want to compare UKIP to the Bloc Québécois, but it's kind of like the protest vote party.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, and not to say that there aren't legitimate beefs that can be had. Stephen Hilton, who is – or was at some one point a foreign policy advisor to David Cameron, said that Cameron is naturally part of the Leave section. But because he's the prime minister, he has to represent the Remain portion. But he says it comes down to the EU being too secretive and impenetrable, which gets back to political concerns in terms of how the EU is administered. And I mean, and this is something that's reverberating across Europe, that, you know, look at Greece, look at you know, Denmark, you know, these places have legitimate beefs with the EU. And there was an editorial, too, I think it was in the Telegraph, that said, like, the concern isn't about the Brexit per se, but it is about that there are great political divisions inside the EU that could break it apart, you know, in more significant ways than one member country leaving. So, if regardless of whether or not Britain votes to stay, and it looks likely they will vote to, or excuse me, remain.
You remain.
There's still a lot of political issues inside the EU that will have to be tackled at some point.
Yeah, and that's one of the arguments as well. I mean, not even just the issues themselves, but they pay like millions of pounds a week just to sort of maintain their, you know, status within the EU. But of course, this referendum will be, we are going to stay, but with conditions. And Cameron made that clear. And some of the conditions were that they want a type of restructuring, I guess, within, and they want, you know, this, they, it's like, well, we'll stay, but we want some improvements. And a lot of that is to do with the centralization versus the decentralization of power among the countries. I think one of them is that they don't want Britain doesn't want to be forced into what they were calling the European super state, right? They didn't want to be part of this sort of just a province within this nation of Europe, right? That's Europe conceptually is more of like a coalition rather than a nation to itself, and they want to get away from that. And I think some of it is, yeah, we want to keep the pound, and you know, certain things need to be. There's a feeling in the UK and a lot of the countries too that there's the EU laws being imposed on them. There's agriculture and you name it, where it's like it's coming from Brussels as opposed to in-house. So, and that's, as we were saying before, going from strictly an economic union to this whole, well, we're going to decide how many chemicals are in your meat pies, whatever, right? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, and rightfully so, I guess we want to keep that stuff in-house because it can, that's the kind of thing that could spiral out of control if... And some people do see it that way, that it is, they've lost control of things like that, domestic issues.
And the thing of it is, though, listening to some of these arguments, it's hard not to hear reaction into arguments over here when we're talking about free trade agreements, when we're talking about things like the I can't remember the name of the European Union one that's being negotiated between Canada and the European Union, but there's that big one that's been... by and large negotiated in secret.
This is called the Canada-European Treaty. I don't know. Yeah, it's
the TPP, another one that's been largely negotiated in secret, but there's these concerns in them that Canada's being dictated to in terms of what standards and what rules we set for ourselves and doing business and having rules imposed on us by these agreements negotiated through other parties. And... this has nothing to do with sort of some of the nationalist leanings, but in terms of just like self-actualization, there's a lot of these same issues that, you know, people, you know, having these rules, no matter what sector of the economy, agriculture, whatever, being imposed on you. Mm-hmm. So there's a bigger issue that way, too. It's like, well, who's imposing these things on us and why are they imposing things and why can't governments stop them from imposing things, and that's the piece of this argument I think has gotten lost is the Leaf side want a bit more self-actualization in this broader discussion in the Eurozone experiment. What unfortunately it's become about is the two extremes of the situation. Where on the Remain side, you have we're going to go to economic hell, and you know we're going to lose billions of dollars and lots of jobs, and we're going to have to like start again from scratch in terms of trade agreements. And then on the other side, it's become, well, we don't want, you know, people with darker skin coming here.
Yeah, well, that's a good way of putting it. But yeah, that's there is some truth to that. But if it doesn't matter the size of the zone. If you're in the economic toilet, you're there, right? Like there's no...
Oh, yeah.
And the hope is, conceptually with free trade and open borders and that there's, you know, you're going to do a solid with the other nations. But, there are lots of pockets within the UK of what I would call despair.
Yeah,
so
for sure.
With the austerity agenda that's been imposed from London... So there's that, but there's also the I have to touch on the Scottish question because that's my people, obviously. in that the SNP in Scotland are saying, well, you know, if Brexit does go ahead, then we are going to not only have another independence referendum, which is something that they said they wouldn't do, but I think it was sort of, well, we won't do it unless conditions, you know, indicate. And I think the Scots. The leading up there tends to be towards the EU because of you know being part of that giant family, let's say. But then again, it depends on the sector that you ask to, because people involved in fishing are like, the European trawlers come and just sort of raid the British waters and take, you know, where we have a heck of a time making a go of it. So a lot of it is by sector and some of it is by, you know, political stripe, let's say. But yeah, that's what's interesting to me too, is that within, you know, I think in a place like Canada, you would see kind of a whipped vote in terms of, you know, all conservatives would be like, no, we want this, we want that. Whereas in the UK, it's almost like a free vote in terms of, and I don't mean the referendum part of it, but in the party, there's differences within the party where some people, you say Boris Johnson, conservative, is like, no, let's go. Who's no longer the mayor of London, by the way. He's just a guy essentially right now, but he's high profile. He's a known A known known. There you go. There's a Rumsfeld. He's a known known. And then there's Cameron and Stay and, you know, different opinions within the same party. But the Stays are huge, too. Labor is staying. And, you know, it's going to be an interesting January.
June
23rd. So.
Yeah. And I mean, it kind of goes to show again that, you know, as people are talking in this country about referendums to look at changing things, referendums tend to favor the status quo, no matter how impassioned the side that wants to change. But yeah, I mean, it's food for thought, and I'll be interested to see the final numbers. But yeah, it looks, I don't know if it'll be a blowout, but it looks blowout-ish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the turnout will be less than they think. They said 65 to 70, yeah. It'll be like 50 probably. And so, wow.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, the more it looks like a blowout, the less likely it is you're going to get people galvanized to come out. And yeah. So that's June 23rd. And speaking of Rumsfeld, or thinking back to the Rumsfeld era, The United States Senate this week this is the United States Senate, the federal level Senate, the one that's like evenly split between the two parties that hate each other's guts. They unanimously passed a resolution to ask the president to declassify 26 pages of the 9/11 report. These 26 pages were heavily, heavily redacted when the report was released, I think back in 2005. But they've been redacted. The people who have seen those pages, people who were on the commission, say that they point to Saudi Arabia, people in the Saudi government, assisting the hijackers of the 9/11 planes, 15 of whom, I'm sure you recall, were of Saudi origin, that they were given intelligence, they were given support. And this is in aid of trying to make it so that families of victims of 9/11 are able to sue the Saudi government for reparations. And the pro side thinks, yes, that this should be allowed. These things should be declassified so that we can get the whole story of the attack. The people who are hedging, and that includes Barack Obama, by the way, believe that it may have diplomatic and legal repercussions for the United States, not the least of which is Saudi Arabia threatening to pull $750 billion in treasury certificates, lest the government decide to freeze their assets in the event of the Saudi government being sued. So,
yes, and that's probably why we will never see these 28 pages until many, many... That's like the Warren Commission stuff coming out 50 years later. It's like the generation after us or after that might... find out what's going on. At least that's my opinion. Just the original report was something like close to 900 pages. But as far as I understand it, these 28 were pulled by Bush himself, among others.
Yeah.
And they're kept in this secret room. Like the conspiracy, if you put in like Saudi 9/11 papers, the first thing that will come up is about 20 different conspiracy sites. Like none of it's just like, you know, dude in the basement saying,
I'll take
the
that
Saudis.
Action.
It's yeah. He's gonna give it a go and see what happens. But if I understand it right, and I think it was the New York Post was saying that the bill passed, but in the fine print, and they tend to do this in the States, these sort of little provisos at the end or whatever.
Yeah.
If I understand it right, there was a clause put into the bill that if the United States and the Saudis are in something called, they're calling it diplomatic talks. I don't even know what that involves or to what degree, if there's any descriptor as to how diplomatic are the talks. Then the families will not be able to sue. It's sort of like it will be on hold.
Yeah.
So they could, in essence, pass this, but then say we're in diplomatic talks and just keep that going indefinitely until the day sometime in the future where they either forget about it or it does surface as to what happens. So, but it sounds like this is a bit of a smoking gun. One example is I can't remember who they were speaking to, but it was somebody that was in on the report saying that. And he was just sort of speculating freely. He didn't actually reveal anything that was in there. But this is stuff that's known. It's like, how is it, you know, a couple of guys can show up in the U.S. They don't speak the language. They don't have any experience. But they get a house. They get flight training. They get all of these things that, you know, wouldn't be afforded to a typical, you know, you as immigrant to the U.S., you probably start off doing the, you know, dishwashing. You pick the whatever. but somehow they're able to go to flight school, which it's a little bit too convenient. And also how the paths of the hijackers and the other parties concerned were able to cross, which hints at a conspiracy, which makes the conspiracy people go, you know, the usual through the roof. But there has to be something to it. So, of course, everybody's like, well, okay, release it. But will we see it? That's the burning question.
Yeah, it's almost to the point, though, where they might have to release it. There's so much.
It'll just be a black sheet with one word. It says Saudi and then blackened.
There's so much demand for it. But you're right. This bit in the fine print that about the diplomatic discussions. And, I mean, it's perfect. It's vague for a particular reason that it's vague because you can say anything is a diplomatic discussion. Yeah, it's one of these things, I think, because it seems to be bipartisan in its support, that it's just, you can't really, if you look at what's going on in American politics, you can't ignore something that gets bilateral support like this, or you have a unanimous vote. And it's going to be incredibly hard, I think, for Obama to justify why to keep this secret. And it's kind of the chicken and the egg thing, because he can come out and say, like, no, we got to keep it classified. Why do we have to keep it classified? Well, I can't tell you because it's classified. And it's just not – and I think –
you don't need to see my identification yet.
Right. It's just that particular, and it's a circular argument with no end. And there was a report that said he was close to making a decision. And I think we've seen this with Obama before, and I'm thinking of the pipeline decision, where he keeps getting painted into further tiny, tiny, tiny corners to where he can't deny the obvious of what he wants to do anymore. And in that case, it was saying no to Keystone. In this case, it's going to be releasing those pages. But I think there will be some kind of negotiation following that where he's going to say, we can't release all of it, but we will release pertinent sections just to show that whatever they say in terms of Saudi involvement or non-involvement, because it's all alleged, of course.
Yes. Everything is couched in a big allegedly. But that's the thing with it, is that there's, as you mentioned, the fear of this money being pulled out. But there's also, and this is top of the pile as well, 1 million barrels of oil a day from Saudi Arabia goes to the U.S. Second only to Canada, Saudi Arabia is the second largest supplier of oil to the U.S.
Of course.
I think it's 11% of their entire oil usage, which powers the first fleet, among other things. So that could potentially, if the Saudis can just say, okay, screw you.
With the situation, the price of oil as it is, that the people are saying that's why this is kind of coming up right now. Oil is cheap. You get it from different places. You know, we could probably make do if the Saudis decide to shut off the tap. But I mean,
it could be, 1973 all over again, potentially.
It could be, but Saudi loves American oil money.
That's true, which they dump back as treasury bills, and it's an endless cycle.
It's the whole thing with Russia, between Russia and Europe again. Like, Europe needs Russian oil, but they're pissed off about Putin and Putin being Putin. And
yeah, will go somewhere. But, of course, when it's not going to America, then that's when we'll see the tantrum. So, yeah, it's trying to find this delicate balance. I think there has to be some kind of workaround. You know, there's going to be some kind of, like, well, we strongly suspect, but we can't prove, and we're not going to name any names because that wouldn't be right, and it should be discussed in the court of law or national courts. There'll be lots of chatter, but I honestly don't think that the 28 pages are going to land on anybody's desk unless we have something WikiLeak-like, unless we have the Panama Papers, where somebody finds their way into the secured room. I just picture this room like in the movies where the diamond is there, and then somebody comes down from the ceiling, Mission Impossible style, and grabs these pieces of paper. It's probably a thumb drive or something. But anyway, it doesn't matter.
Speaking of that, I did Google Saudi 9/11 papers.
What was the first thing that came up?
Saudi Arabia 9/11 and what we know about the secret papers, which is an independent article, the UK Independent. And then there's a CBS report from 60 Minutes.
I think your Google is probably trained towards sensible sites, though. I'd like to think mine is, but the ones I got were like 9/11 Truth and all that stuff. It's like,
I'm gonna Google keep Saudi 9/11 conspiracy.
Oh, as soon as you put conspiracy in, that's it. There'll be like 20 million
9/11
hits.
Conspiracy theories. Why U.S. Yeah. government and Saudi Arabia don't want Americans. Dot dot dot. I can't read the rest of it because it trails off.
Who's the website though?
That would be zerohedge.com.
There you go.
Which a reputable. I've never heard of.
Yeah, exactly. If you've never heard of it, then it's a conspiracy site.
Popularresistance.org.
Oh, there you go.
Is the real 9/11 conspiracy Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, I'd be careful what you're Googling there because some of it's probably quite questionable. But
yeah.
Don't click on anything, Adam. Oh, my God.
No. Only sensible clicking here.
Yeah. Hope so.
But yeah, it's the conspiracy theories are a big part of this, of course, because you had a Saudi official. I can't remember who it was. But he came out the other day saying there's nothing to know because it was a false flag operation. It was the American government trying to jumpstart the war on terror, what they would eventually call the war on terror. And it's like, no, don't say that. Don't feed the beast of mm-hmm. the. And I know you're trying to stick up for your country and your people and all that, but like. Only the Alex Joneses of the world.
There you go. There's a perfect example. Yeah.
Are you know, buying. Worth noting, Donald Trump supporter Alex Jones, by the way, are trying to sell that Kool-Aid, and it seems to be an easy sell for a lot of people, unfortunately. And we don't need like people who are in like rational positions of authority in foreign countries to feed that beast. And it was so vehement and so out of the, I don't know, the crazy pool yeah. of that it's there's got to be something in there. And I think it's just, I think you confront the crazy train conspiracy stuff with yeah. more openness. So in the interest of openness and like putting a pin in the crazy conspiracy stuff, yeah, just
yeah,
get those things to the Xerox, man.
We're in Obama birth certificate territory, right? Like,
yeah.
But, and that's the thing about it too, is that It should come out for sure. I mean, there's no reasons why it shouldn't, especially if it's past the Senate, right? So okay, but
yeah.
let's get it out there. But there's a bit of, I wouldn't say counter spin, but the Saudis have came out with some kind of glossy report about how, and I haven't seen it, their efforts to fight terrorism. I think it's probably, you know, talking about Daesh and whoever else that they're
yeah.
they're just trying to do this spin, I guess. They've got their spin doctors as well. I don't know if they talk about Yemen or other places, but which is another can of worms for sure. But it sounds like they're trying to put it forward. It's like, well, you know, we're not so bad as you think we are. And so it almost sounds like counterspin to what may or may not be unearthed with this. So spin goes always. I was going to say both ways, but there's, you know, everybody's got their spin, so glossy
spin,
papers are not.
The spin goes on. Yeah.
PDFs aren't necessarily that glossy, are they? But.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to call that a topic and take a break for some PSAs and some music, and then we'll come back with more topics, because this is Open Sources, and you're listening to Open Sources here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
You're listening to the CFRU 93.3 FM. If you don't want me, set me free. Exactly whom I'm supposed to be. Don't you know which clothes even fit me? Come on and let me know. Should I cool it or should I blow?
What are those guys saying? No one really knows. From something. From Combat Rock. That was The Clash. 1982. Should I Stay or Should I Go?
Which is now being used to advertise Super 8 or
what?
Comfort Inn or one of those.
Oh, no. Really?
Yeah.
I'm going to cry. Oh, how can they do that? I don't know. I guess it's all about money eventually.
Because so, if you got to go, stay at a Comfort Inn.
So, and of course, we send that out to former Prime Minister, 22nd Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper. What's his middle name again?
Who is that? No, actually, that's a good question. I don't remember.
For 10 points, Adam, who was Stephen James? It's got to be something
Stephen
like that.
Stephen James Harper? Got to be something. Limit, hold on.
Got to be something.
I feel like this is
waspy.
A rabbit hole.
It's also to the people.
Joseph. Stephen Joseph Harper.
Also
age
out
57.
Goes out to the people of the UK. Should
educated
he stay?
Educated at the University of Calgary in 1993. I put a, for the show notes for this, I put like a, like the classic when he first ran for Parliament.
When he was Steve Harper. Steve-O.
He looks like, I mean, his hair is a bit bigger.
The helmet is still
I don't know what it was. It was like
it's political hair. We shouldn't really make fun of people's hair, but there is that. It's like it's molded. It's very much along the lines of I can't believe we're talking about dedicating this much time to his hair, but there is something to it. There is something to political hair.
Well, he dedicated a lot of time to the current prime minister's hair. So turnabout is fair play.
Oh, well, that's true. Yeah. So,
but yeah. So Globe and Mail came out yesterday. I think it was yesterday. Said that. A friend told them that
sources say yes.
Harper is, quote, not going to be there, there being the House of Commons, when the House returns in September. So a lot of people are assuming he's making a speech to the Conservative Convention in Vancouver tonight. In that speech, which is going to come after...
The singing of Sweet Caroline?
I don't know. It was going to say after a clip package. That might be in the clip package.
Oh, it'll definitely be in the clip package.
That he's going to make the speech, and at the end, announce that he will be stepping down as member of Parliament for Calgary Heritage. And actually, he has been in the House a lot. He hasn't got up to talk. You won't catch him like... It's funny. I think it was Craig Oliver at CTV said like there was a time where the press were like standing there in a hallway in Center Block and they saw him like come around the corner with his like lunch in a brown bag and he kind of slinked away.
Just a regular working Joe, that Harper would tell you, man.
Yeah, and
putting in his time, punching the clock.
So he's been like, but he's been super careful not to like do anything or say anything that like attracts attention. So this is going to be like a pretty big deal. It's like his first speech since October 19th. It's going to be like his first public statement in like 8 months.
He's going to say he had laryngitis or something, but I love that shot. I think it was on CBC showing him, they highlighting the fact that he went out the side door beside the speaker. Like he doesn't go out with everybody else. He just sort of did this deke. Because I guess once you're the prime minister, you know all the secret passages, and then it probably goes up the peace tower where the, you know.
Yeah, once you've seen the Marauders map.
Yes.
Yeah.
or the closets to hide in when things go down.
Ooh,
but, soon.
That was,
yeah, probably. Always too soon for that. Yeah, I better watch it, or what's his name will come after me if I.
Vickers?
Great
yeah.
stuff.
Jeez.
Better watch what I say. He might be pounding the door down and fly all the way over from
Did
Ireland.
Did you make him the new James Bond?
Yes. But he didn't tackle the guy. There was just a sort of waltz. Anyway, that's a topic for another day, probably. Back to Steve. Yes, he has been a bit of a phantom. He is probably the... he's just a bit of a ghost, a specter haunts Parliament Hill, and it is Stephen Harper. I think it's difficult for him to do anything specifically because of his position and the sort of trend... Well, it's not sort of a trend. It is a trend. The trend away from Harperism.
Yeah.
The Harper Tories, they need to sort of... Not get over that, but there's definitely a change in the air for the party. So I think he's, you know, doing the guy doesn't do anything without a reason or his handlers telling him what to do, I suppose. So he's saying, you know, Steve, just lay low. We'll do this thing, and then you can go and get your corporate appointments or whatever. Because it sounds like that's what's going to happen. One of them that was floated was KKR Private Equity.
Yeah,
this is a a firm that specializes in leveraged buyouts, a.k.a. sharks, in my view anyway.
As in Shark Tank, not Jaws.
No, as in, you know, let's just eat companies.
Yeah, Shark Tank.
Like you would. Yeah, I guess so. Shark Tank, yes. Their largest buyout was the Nabisco buyout in the 80s. It was the biggest for years and years and years when Nabisco and R.J. Reynolds Tobacco merged. And also in Canada... everybody probably remembers this when Shoppers Drug Mart became a thing. It just went from being a drugstore to this like thing where there's Shoppers, any town you went to, it was like, wow, there's a huge Shoppers Drug Mart here. Why? That's usually what happens with equity buyouts. But that's, anyway, it's been hinted at that may be part of his future plans, and also some of this vague starting some kind of international institute where he's going to stay away from speaking about domestic issues, but he's going to talk about foreign policy. And I think it sounds like he'd just be a bit of a middleman between corporations, let's say, and Canadian companies. And okay, how do I navigate my dealings with Nepal? That kind of organization. And they would probably every once in a while release statements like, oh, let's say the Fraser Institute does, and talk about some sort of trade deal or why so-and-so is bad or why we hate Russia or why, you know, we can't say anything bad about Israel, that kind of stuff. I think that's what we're going to see. It's very amorphous. I don't think – it sounds like – and I can't remember who quoted it saying that Steve pretty much didn't have a plan because he probably thought in his mind he was going to be prime minister again. So there didn't seem to be a plan B, and it's taken this long for this to evolve. So that's what's happening. Something – maybe he does have something up his sleeve. I'm sure – you know, this. Maybe that's what he does in Parliament. Instead of speaking, he just sort of draws up on the napkin or on the official stationery. It's like, I can do this. I'm going to retire. Because he could retire, right? He could retire and have a pretty sweet pension right now. He'd been an MP and the prime minister long enough that he could just retire now.
Yeah,
he doesn't have to do anything. But he is an intellectual. So I think he has his vision and he wants it out there because – and he can also make a lot of money doing what he's planning to do.
Well, and that's kind of the thing. I mean, his entire life has been about public service because he, you know, he was in a conservative think tank. He was an MP. Then he was in the
reform.
Reform MP. Then he was like working in you know, like sort of the non-governmental organization structure. Then he comes back to, and then forms the Conservative Party and is prime minister for 10 years.
Yep.
So that's sort of his life. So yeah, now's I mean, like a lot of politicians, he's like ready to cash in, and you know, can't blame him. They all do it. And that's fine. The Invisible Man routine is kind of what continues to stick out to me is, you know, this like going in the sideways and, you know, on Parliament Hill and
blinking, you'll miss him.
Like sneaking out the back door of Rideau Hall and on the morning of the swearing in and. Because you know he has there's a ceremonial function he had to do, but you know, like don't look at me. The Phantom of the Opera thing, which is an ongoing joke. Vice described him as a separated husband that moved into the basement.
like Milhouse's dad.
Yes. A piece on CBC, I think it was CBC, is like, we're going to say goodbye to a stubborn loner who was genuinely uninterested in being liked. So, I mean, it's kind of weird that we're... It's almost like backhanded compliments. I don't read anything too terribly malicious into these characterizations, but, I mean, it does sort of... What you said, how there didn't seem to be a plan B, even though...
No,
the writing was kind of – this was a very close election. So there was very good odds. He was not going to get back in, whether it was Mulcair or Trudeau. I mean, there was 2-1 odds against. But there was no plan B, and I think he's had a difficult time adjusting to the idea that he didn't just lose, though. He lost big. It wasn't just a – people are like, well, we're going to give someone else a try. We'll see how they do. People are like, no, we have absolutely had enough of you, and we're going to go with this kid with the nice hair. And that – and you can't tell me that didn't sting. The viciousness of the campaigning, the personal attacks, the soccer mom and the old guy and the lone Indian guy in the room doing the interview stuff, that was vicious personal crap.
Yeah.
And he hates Trudeau. He has to sit there and stew as Trudeau and the Liberals.
Prime Minister. Yeah.
Not only Prime Minister, but undoing his agenda. Mm-hmm.
Elbows and all.
Between – but
something Harper never would have done, by the way. To his credit, he wouldn't have done that.
I would agree with that. Yes, to his credit. But on top of that, it's like it's a two-way friend now, because remember a couple of months ago, the Supreme Court came out and it's like, no, we're not going to have mandatory minimums, and no, all your crime legislation is kind of unconstitutional, so we're going to undo that.
And the Supreme Court's full of pinkos. But yeah, I mean, that's not even the government undoing it. It's the Supreme Court of the land enforcing the law of the land, saying that, no, you can't do this, 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 and this.
And the Capitol Commission, they not only did they move
Yeah.
The victims against communism, another huge conservative thing. They not only did they move it, they downsized it. They're putting it in a corner somewhere where you're probably going to have to be directed to it on a map.
And everybody's excited about the census coming back. So much so the damn thing blew up. It's like that's indicative of something that, you know, people want good quality data so we can decide what to do with this nation, regardless of who's in power.
The
conservatives did a lot of dumbass things, and that was one of them.
Most anticipated stuff this summer: the Captain America movie, Hillside, and the census. That's like what people are like so stoked this summer about.
We got the long one. I'm like, yeah, this is great.
Oh, we just got the short one.
Oh, because I was a census taker back in the day, and this online business is fantastic. Because believe me, folks, census taking was not cool. It paid pretty good, but the crap you have to take from the public.
You should have waited a couple of decades. You would have been treated like unto gods now if you're one of those manual census guys.
Here.
It's the census guy. Get it. Let's go out to the backyard and start the barbecue.
Let's have cake. Yes. Yeah. Now it's like, get off my lawn. So that's the kind of thing, you know, a complete sea change at the top, and it's got to be difficult. For Harper, even though resounding won a seat, and of course whoever else conservative runs in Calgary Heritage will be installed. Like, there's no, it's one of those ones. Isn't one of those ridings was like 90% or something? It's just always conservative. Perhaps not. And the name too, Calgary Heritage, like it just suits him. So like it just,
yeah,
it's like a heritage moment. It's with, also a riding.
Yeah, with the old stock Canadian stuff that worked. I mean, because I think that's a new riding.
In the redrawing, probably. Yeah,
yeah, it was rejiggered. So
anywhere the guy ran in Alberta would have been safe, probably. Almost anywhere.
Yeah, so I mean, that by-election is probably, I don't know who was going to run to replace him in Calgary Heritage, but I'm going to call the election now and say Conservative X, whoever that may be, is the winner in that by-election.
Yeah, don't bet against him, folks, because he's probably right.
Yeah.
Although it would be interesting if it did go something else. That would be probably. Depends who runs. Depends.
That might be a bigger bitch slap to
Danielle Smith or somebody surfaces. Daniel says, I'm going to run. Yeah. I just picked the name out of the hat. Brian Jean.
Jim Prentice.
Jim Prentice, who knows? Talk about back from the dead.
Nahid Nenshi says he's not going to do it.
Oh,
I don't know.
He would win.
I'm sure he would. But
he wouldn't run as a conservative.
I wouldn't think
he'd
so.
He'd run as a liberal.
Probably.
He'd run as a green and double their numbers. That'd be good. This is all speculative fiction, folks. This is what we do. That's what we do in our spare time. We sit around and go,
we do speculative fiction.
Speculative political fiction.
I don't know if I'd characterize what we do as fiction, but there you go.
Prime Minister Nenshi.
It might happen.
Yes.
It might happen. I don't know what his ambitions are, but it might happen. Okay, we're going to talk about a bit more generally about this editorial. If you don't know who Edward Keenan is, he's a columnist. I think he used to be... And the editor of iWeekly?
The name's very familiar, but I've seen his byline lots.
So, but I know his column used to be in iWeekly, and then when they shuttered iWeekly, he went over to the Toronto Star.
Which is owned by the Star, Tor Star anyway, so.
So he's generally a pretty progressive guy on most issues. He posted an editorial, though, last weekend where he was trying to provoke conversation because there was a topic that came down at the Executive Council of the Mayor's Office in Toronto this week about how the city is at a tipping point. They keep trying to keep their tax rate in line, the increase of the annual tax rate in line with the rate of inflation. They actually increased it less than the rate of inflation the last several years. But it's causing some difficulties because Toronto's a growing city, of course. The cost of most things just keep going up. They have big ambitions, big plans, infrastructure, of course, crumbling. Transit is woefully underserviced in certain areas. They need the influx of cash. There's a whole Gardner situation. There's some incredibly big decisions that have to be done, that have to be made, and it's going to require capital in order to raise that. So the question is, how do you raise capital? You have a segment of people who don't want their taxes raised at all and thinks that City Hall is a, spendthrifty, and it likes to spend it more than make it. And you have other people who are like, we have to pay for these things, and infrastructure, transit, arts and culture, parks, all this, city buildings cost money. And if we're not going to do that through property taxes, you have to either A, tell us what you're going to cut, where you're going to find $1 billion with specific examples, or B, where else you can get revenue. And I thought that was an interesting place to discuss our situation here in Guelph, because, I mean, a lot of these arguments are very much the same. And, of course, there's been big ticket items the last couple of weeks at council, particularly what was going on with district energy and the shortfall in revenue there. And City Council passed GEERS this week, or at least the pilot version of GEERS, to see if that pilot project can be more sustainable, or to see if that project can be sustainable in a broader sense beyond the 20 house pilot project. So,
yeah, and this is always the challenge too, is finding the revenue, because there's, and I think in Toronto particularly, the whole anti-tax thing is a kind of a Ford hangover in terms of just people like, my taxes, blah, blah, blah. But yeah. on paper, their taxes, if you adjust, as you said, adjusted to inflation, it's gone down like almost 5%.
Yeah.
So the number will seem bigger because your house has been reassessed, but taxes haven't actually gone up. But then, of course, there are the other ways too, and we've seen it here in Guelph, where it was interesting how they said that the customer base on water and wastewater charges went up, but that's not completely true because the water rate also went up. It was like 4%.
Right.
So that's how you find other revenue. There's, you know, like you said, you cut things, you find other streams, or you just plain out and out increase taxes. But when, you know, it's a bit stealth when you increase the water rate. It's essentially a tax, right? Especially when they argue it's like, well, consumption's down, so but we need to increase the rate. Same thing happened with hydro. I mean, those bills, those are probably the two main bills that people get that they see, that they physically see, that come from the city, Guelph Hydro, and then the water that are incorporated together, that have been so high they've split them into two, so you don't, you're, you know, you don't completely freak out that you're it's doubled or trebled in some cases. So that's a bit of creative accounting, but it has gone up, right? So that's how you get money. It's like an average of $31 a house. That's another revenue stream to be explored. But then there's other things too in Guelph, like the solid waste stream, which has been a bit of a turkey. That was at a loss, right? Was it $2.6 million? That was a high hopes thing. It's like, we're going to make money recycling. Was it Michigan's trash?
Yes.
And it didn't pan out.
And that had to do with that particular contract.
Yeah.
That was going to get net $2.2 million in revenue for the city. It was going to make us money. And that was kind of the point of the we're going to build this super swank, top-of-the-line waste diversion center.
And full of garbage, yes.
Yeah, and that has not come to pass.
Yeah. I still don't see the logic of trucking garbage to deal with it, but that's just my own personal view.
It's right.
I understand it because it is revenue stream, which is what everybody's looking for. Then there's been other sort of smaller things too that all add up, like paying more for I think the parks overtime was pretty high last year. I think a lot of that was to do with trees coming down. There was certainly a lot of them came down to Royal City Park. So this is kind of the things you can't really control. And what they paid more money on the Flanders Field celebration, which you could argue this probably shouldn't have happened. It's nice, but so you can nickel and dime and pick away at budgets and say, but you know, the whole sort of screaming at the whole, my taxes are too damn high. That's pointless after a while, because that's what Keenan was talking about too. It's like, rather than over and over again every year, the city people will come and say, we need to do something. But there's never, ever really a concrete plan, is it? There's never a plan to say, we're going to do this. We're going to, you know, at least in Ford's case, he said, we're going to cut this. We're going to get rid of this. People lost their minds, right?
Right.
But it's a little bit, so like, well, we need a plan, but we don't really have a plan. So the money should come from here, right? Like,
well, the problem is, though, everyone has their own kind of particular ideas. And I went to the city website just to see how the percentages break down in terms of the property tax pool, where it all goes. 17.4% goes to police. 11.2% goes to social services. 7.2% goes to administration. 7.1% goes to roads and sidewalks. 11.7 goes to fire. Something like, let's say, like culture and tourism. That's like a big bugaboo for certain, let's just call them certain people.
Yes.
2.8%.
Which is nothing.
Right. It's infrastructure. And I guess this is infrastructure, like maybe buildings and maintenance and things.
Pipes.
0.9%.
That's it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Mayor and council, 0.4. Like every time there's a pay increase for council,
yeah.
0.4%.
That's a drop in the bucket.
Yeah. And the
moment so where do we find the efficiencies? Where do we get the pen and say, I don't know, I always say police. But the police did actually find, what did they held back in some hirings? So they left some slots empty to the tune of 726K, which is probably seven people as far as the police go.
Right.
Because, you know, they're paid very well.
But I mean,
no one wants to argue against cutting the police budget because that's a big... That's a big no-no, it seems. Even though, I mean, they'll say, well, this is one of the safest cities in Canada because we pay so much for police. But try and touch it, people lose their minds. Bring it up, I'm going to start, somebody's going to come
tackle
me.
It's not quite true because a lot of people are, like, spitting mad about the $34 million to renovate police headquarters.
Yes.
That's, like, people are out of their minds about that.
But that, and that better be it. You know, like
right.
We were talking about when Phil Ault was here in terms of this, the new station at South End, and then there was some grumbling about, well, it's not really what we were looking for.
Right.
So it's not buyer's remorse. It's like, no, this is what you get because this is what was decided on, right? So,
mm-hmm.
And of course, these things are never what they say. I'm not specifically picking on the police, but when they come up with a project like this and say $34 million, it's going to be more. They will dig that parking lot and find barrels or like we've seen with the pipes.
Right, just down the
you
road.
Know,
yeah.
It was like $1 million just to get rid of the mystery barrels. It was like, I don't know who put those there. So, you know, it's never what they say. Nothing is ever on budget. Please call or write and correct me. But I've never seen it. In my years of the public service and that, I've never seen anything on budget.
You're not wrong what they are promising that it'll come in on time and on budget because of the things they've put into place after Urbicon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not
there
saying...
You go. Prime example.
Yes, and yeah. I'm not saying that I believe that, but that is the point they're trying to make is that they recognize that. And it is interesting what they might dig up because, you know, what was in that parking lot across the road from the police station.
It's one of the most toxic sites in town, if I understand.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's what they covered over. It's like it's the same over at Imico.
Yeah.
Where they're going to spend a ton of money, you know, brownfielding and then turning into affordable housing, which I'm all for. But, you know, there's other ways to deal with brownfields than digging them up. Like, I don't know, putting a bunch of solar panels on top. Anyway, so now we're pie in the skying stuff, but that costs money. Where's the money going to come from? There are ways to do these things, right?
Yeah.
Creative thinking outside the box or whatever. Establish a cooperative and get everybody in town to be a member of that cooperative and put solar panels on it.
Yeah, I think though it starts with, first of all, recognizing that taxpayer isn't a special class. Everyone pays taxes in their own way.
Yeah.
And you know,
I just like to think there's
special. I really hate the word taxpayer now because it's when people say it, it's like it's a special class. Only I am a taxpayer. All you like you and me who like services and like open government and like aspirational things, we're not taxpayers because we're not thinking about the money first. And I think that's an attitude that has to go. The second thing that has to go is the nickel and diming stuff, because that's what's the problem with transit right now.
Mm-hmm.
Is they shut off the peak service for the summer to save $750,000. Meanwhile, you go on Facebook, Twitter, you go to the Guelph Transit feed. Every other post is a complaint about something gone wrong on transit. And that's, I mean, for every man, woman, and child of Guelph, that comes down to $6 a month. $6 a month they're saving. Or $6 a year, I should say. $6 a year they're saving.
I gladly
50
write
cents a month.
Gladly write a check to put that right. But the problem is, what taxpayer is code for property owner. When people do the whole taxpayer thing, it's code for somebody who owns property.
Exactly.
So technically, that's me too, but I don't use that because usually when people say, I'm a taxpayer, they're generally going to be a jerk about something, in my view. Because it's like, yeah, we all pay taxes, whether it's, you know, we just do. It's consumption taxes. It's not, you know, no one is immune to it. It's very difficult to not pay taxes.
But
if you're paying a couple grand on your house, then
right.
That's...
And I used to say that, too. And then I had a conversation with somebody. He pointed out, well, no, you're a renter. And the person who owns your home that you rent from pays the property taxes because
of your rent. Yeah, exactly.
And you know who said that to me?
Who?
Former Progressive Conservative candidate Greg Shirk.
Well, there you go.
So, there you go. There you go for Open Sources Guelph this week. That's it for our show today. You can stay connected to us all week long at opensourcesguelph.com, Open Sources Newswire on Facebook at OS_Guelph, on Twitter. And of course, you can find us on Podbean. You can download all the recent episodes on the Guelph Politicast channel and listen to them on whatever fine device you listen to podcasts on. You can stay connected to me at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter or at guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter. I'd also like to say a shout out to Boss Taylor, who will be competing in the Special Olympics this weekend, who
Excellent.
Sits in this chair a couple of times a week. I'm not much in the Olympics, but I love the Special Olympics, and it's great that it's in town, and check out some events if you can.
And yeah, there'll be events all over town in the next couple of weeks, so get out and enjoy. You can also enjoy AJ Sounds Good to Me coming up next here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We'll see you next time.